Hello, welcome to the ATL Charlie Hoops podcast. I'm Robbie Callen. Joining me, as always, is Bo Cherney from Hawks Hoop. Bo, how are you doing?
I'm relaxed, as always, Robbie. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Bo's rocking a new laptop today. RIP the old one.
But it's still alive. It's just keyboard doesn't
is
work.
It?
Yeah, it's, the keyboard doesn't work.
Okay,
but it's,
so you're on the desktop laptop vibe like your boy.
I would be, but I'm not using it anymore, but it's still alive.
Okay, well, that's good. We are here to talk some basketball stuff, as usual, tell some stories. Got a good one for you tonight. And we're going to start with the Milwaukee Bucks, because that seems like a logical place to start. But mainly because Giannis Antetokounmpo is doing insane things almost on a nightly basis at this point, and I'm really confused how we need to evaluate him. He's 19, he has flaws in his game, but athletically there doesn't seem to be a comparison or ceiling that you can even, like, put to him. I've seen people compare him to KD. That's unfair. He's not that shooter. You just don't know how to, he's his own guy. Like, how do you go about that?
I mean, I'm sort of at the same point where you are, where I'm just kind of lost, because we've never seen anybody that has like a body like he does. I mean, we've seen people come across, obviously, that are their own outlier, and it's that kind of same thing. We have to wait a while, see what they do in terms of evaluating them. But with Giannis, it's also hard because he's 19, where sometimes guys have been in college for a year, maybe a couple years before coming to the NBA, so you have a little bit more on their game. But, I mean, he's just so unique about that. I mean, there's really – I don't really know how to do it. I mean, there's...
Yeah, the play that really kind of... There have been a couple in the last 2 weeks. First was the Euro step finger roll from the three-point line. I think it was last week.
That was completely legal dribble, too.
Yeah, and we were all like, holy shit, this dude's insane. And then he somehow one-upped himself on that with like a Euro step pro hop dunk. I don't remember who he dunked on, but the poor person, rest in peace. And he just, his length, his athleticism is just so incredible. And it's fun seeing them be able to get up and down. Like, Jason Kidd's just completely freed that team up to do whatever they feel like they can do physically. Like, he just lets Jabari run. He lets Giannis run. Everybody is allowed to dribble the basketball. Like, you see, like, four or five different guys bringing the ball up the floor for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really kind of, it's intriguing to me, because if you remember how slow and boring the Nets were,
yeah,
this wasn't what I expected out of a Jason Kidd team. I've been really impressed by all the first-year coaches this year. Him, Kerr, like, they've all done really well. And I'm really, well, I guess he's not a first-year coach, but new coach in a new place. And I'm impressed by how he's adapted to that young team and has them playing. I didn't really expect that, but it looks like the Nets kind of made the wrong move.
I mean, I'm not sure I expected this much out of his defense from him. Like, I know the Bucks have completely different pieces than what the Nets had. I mean, the Bucks have length for days in terms of bodies in the front court. I mean, we all know Giannis, but then they have Larry Sanders and John Henson. I mean, they just have so much length, and their defense is so good. Like, I mean, with the Nets, I didn't know Jason Kidd could really handle having a defensive scheme that could fit a team like this. But I mean, it's working. They're in the top 10 in defense. So,
yeah, I mean, he does such a good job of having them kind of roam around and just use their length to bother people. Like, they don't pressure too much, but they know they have the length to recover and the length on the back end, so he allows them to take some gambles to try to jump in passing lanes. Like, you see Giannis and Jabari and these guys get in passing lanes a lot, especially when Henson's on the floor, because they know they have that back line covered. And Larry Sanders, you know, I mean, when they've got those two out there, they can be more aggressive on the perimeter, and he lets them do that.
Also, a really good rebound. I mean, this goes with the link. A really good rebounding team.
Sure.
I mean, it's also Having Zaza doesn't hurt. Zaza's still good. He's not exactly the, you know, the Link prototype that the rest of the guys are, but I mean, they protect the glass on both ends of the floor. They, you know, disrupt shots. You know, they, like you said, they roam around just disrupting passes and everything with, you know, raw athleticism without really getting too much out of position. So, I mean, they're just a really unique team, and since the East is so terrible, it's kind of interesting to see where they could go.
I mean, it wouldn't shock me if they're a playoff team. I mean, you look at, we kind of expected Charlotte to be something, and you saw them.
Oh, good God, that was.
You saw them last night. What was it, 80-36 at one point?
Yeah.
Like, they're just really a bad basketball team.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly don't know where they go, but you think about who gets in the East. It's like, you look at where people are at, and we do this almost every week, it feels like. And you look past Atlanta, Miami, who's there? I mean, Milwaukee legitimately might be the sixth best team in the East.
I mean, it's not even like they're, you know, like where, say, Orlando is, where, or was a little bit earlier in the season before they lost four in a row, where right. they were like 6-8, and you're just like, oh, maybe they could sneak in there. I mean, Milwaukee's 10-8. They're over 500. They're
solidly there.
Yeah. They have like a 3-game cushion, I think.
I mean, the East is a dumpster fire, but I don't know. Maybe they can do something. They're definitely a fun team. I think that's the other thing. There's not many fun teams. And it would be great to get a Milwaukee in the playoffs because I really don't want to watch a Brooklyn and an Indiana and these teams in a series. Like, they're just brutal.
I mean, as good as Toronto is, and they're kind of fun. I think, I don't even say that from like a basketball purist standpoint. I think from a, you know, like a regular fan, if they'd watch them, they would enjoy watching them. Mm-hmm. But a Toronto, like if it's like Toronto, Indiana, or Toronto, Brooklyn, it's like an 8 seed. First day, I'm like, that'll be miserable. Like, no one wants to watch that.
Mm-mm. I mean, for something like that, like, I mean, I guess Toronto, Brooklyn, just because there's clearly some animosity between those teams from last year.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we might get Masai Uri saying "fuck Brooklyn" again.
Like, worth it.
If we get that, I'm fine with Brooklyn being in the playoffs. Like, get swept in four, and let Masai yell about you. Like, that'd be great. Like, anytime you can get a GM cussing about another team, you got.
But otherwise, basketball wise, it's gonna be miserable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's mostly Brooklyn, but I mean, Toronto is kind of. I mean, they're just.
But I mean,
they're not terrible. In terms of fun, I mean, they're definitely
fun.
A great team.
At this point, that's what I care about. Fun teams. Toronto, pretty fun. You know, they get up and down. They got probably the best bench in the league. Washington's fun when John Wall plays.
Mm-hmm.
When he's off the floor, they're not nearly as much fun. Hawks can be fun, can be miserable, because that's what the Hawks almost always are.
Yeah.
Milwaukee's fun. Cleveland will be fun. Chicago's fun if you into that sort of thing. Like,
if you're a masochist, like, Chicago's kind of fun.
Are you into bondage? Then the Bulls might be for you. Like, okay, there you go. The Knicks are fun in a tragic way. Honestly, Philly's a fun team to watch until the fourth quarter. They compete a lot.
And then they just kind of fall off.
And then they find magical ways to lose games.
I mean, like, they just run out of gas, essentially, because they give it their all for three quarters, and they're still losing by, like, 10, and then just by then, they're still...
Did you see that arena the other night? Like, it was, like, game 7 of the finals in there when they were within 3 points at the end. I felt so bad for those people. They were up. They were standing up. They were so ready.
I did not see that. I was at the Hawks game, unfortunately.
Oh, my goodness. They were... It was hilarious. Like, they had it on. NBA TV had it on. I think Isaiah Thomas was on there. Like, the people at NBA TV are actively rooting for them. Like, it's hilarious. Like, they're trying so hard, and then Tony Roten throws it away in the last minute, and he's been playing so well. And it's just like, they're just built to lose so well. And it's one of those things where it's like, I understand what you're doing, and... But there's something to be said for knowing how to win. I mean, it's something that I think a lot of people don't like to talk about because it's not something you can quantify. Like, you can't be like, you know, people kind of shrug off, okay, learning to win, that sort of thing. But literally any athlete will tell you, like LeBron will tell you, like Miami, he had to learn how to do that. And
I mean, there's a certain...
Like, some of these guys have never won an NBA game.
Right. I mean, even learning to win isn't just some, like, catchphrase to say, like, you know, you need veterans or whatever. I mean, it's learning how to execute, like, in the game, learning how to keep your composure, learning how to, you know, get your teammates motivated and stuff like that. I mean, it's real things. It's just hard to quantify. And if you're, I don't know, going to lose every game this year, that just kind of, like, I feel like that can just put, like, a complete damper on your mentality towards basketball.
Like, right, because the thing is, like, Brett Brown's trying to get them to win, and I know he is. But you look at how they play, and they don't play in a way consistently that even if you add better pieces in, they're not playing. The guys that they have aren't learning to play how they'll need to play when it's time to win. Tony Roten's not going to be able to shoot like that. I mean, Tony Roten might not be on the squad.
Right.
But Tony, you know, Nerlens Noel's not a number one guy, option on offense. He's not a top guy. Like, he shouldn't be getting shots. Like, he's not going to be getting jump shots. And maybe he's developing a jumper a little bit, but these guys aren't learning to play in the roles that they're going to need to play. And I think it's going to be hard for some of them to kind of go back to that. It's going to take time. And at some point, you run out of time to do that. The window, as wide as it feels for Philly, like, guys are going to go to free agency, guys are going to go away, and you're going to find yourself in a constant building. I know it's kind of cute and stuff like that, but at some point you have to think, like, they're doing somewhat a detriment to the future even by trying to build their building.
The way I'm looking at it is just, like, at what point do you plan to start actually, you know, being a contender, or at least a playoff team? Like, at what point, like, is it, you know, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 4 years from now? Like, are you even going to have a job, like, 4 years from now if they're still not, like, doing this? Like, they're not going to be doing this, but if they're not, like, in the playoffs?
Yeah,
like,
at what point
do you be like, okay, like, what are we supposed to do now? Like,
well, Sarge comes over in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you figure they've got to start then. But, again, you're like, and the other thing is, it's not like drafting is a known science, you know? I mean, the other thing is, you know, you look at the best players this year, they don't need a big man. They don't need Jahlil Okafor.
That's what I have,
you cannot play Jahlil Okafor and Nerlens Noel together for 35 minutes a night. I don't believe you can. Just from a floor spacing perspective, like, Jahlil Okafor is on the block. Like, that's where he lives.
I was talking to Brad Rowland about this, and it's just like, so, I mean, if you go 0-80, or they're not going to go 0-82. If they get the first pick, like, what do you do with it? Because it looks like Jahlil Okafor is going to be that guy at number one. Do you take him and try to offload Noel or Embiid? You know, and you're not going to get a good price for him, probably, that you'd expect to get in a normal situation, because Noel's played one season, and Embiid hasn't played yet.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what you would look to get for him since you're in that building perspective. Are you going to try to get, you know, just first round picks for them? Like,
I mean, here,
you're not
going to.
Apparently, they don't want players for them. So.
Right. So my question is, do they go after? Do they try to trade back to, like, the third pick if somebody there has a couple first rounders? I think that's what they do, and try to get, like, a Moutier or somebody like that.
Mm-hmm.
But
I mean, do you trade back?
You might not have a dance partner. Yeah. You know, you might not have somebody that's worth trading from. Let's say they do get number one. You might not have somebody that has two first-rounders in a spot where you can get Moutier. You might gamble and drop back to, like, five,
and
maybe get two lotto picks and get 5 and 14, but you might miss your guy. So do you reach at number one for a need?
That's another thing. Like, if they're at number one and they're trying to trade, how many teams are going to be, like, willing to trade with them knowing that they kind of have to, you know, screw up?
That's
so, I mean, they're going to have to do something. Someone below them might just be like, hey, let them, you know.
Yeah, because if you're at number three, like, let's say you're at number five and you also have 12. you're probably gonna they're probably gonna ask for a second rounder on top of that,
mm-hmm.
because they know the value of Okafor. And you'd love to get Okafor, but pretty deep draft. You know they have to go guard. Maybe one of the guys you like falls. This is deep with big men. You know, there's a lot of bigs here. You know, it's funny. Everybody talking about last year's class. When I would talk to guys in the Hawks front office, they talked about this class.
Yeah, I remember that.
You know,
I remember them saying that. Like, no, this 2014 is pretty good. 2015 is gonna be really good.
Yeah, they love this class. You know, you got Towns, you got Okafor, Moody, you got a lot of players. And for what last year had at the top, this one might be like deeper in the lottery. So, I mean, you think like Noah Vonleh went eighth. Noah Vonleh is not a player right now.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even notice he was in until I heard he scored, and then it was like, oh, he's playing like 10 minutes. I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, I mean, he's not there. He's a project. I don't know if it's funny, you know, Philly people are so defensive about the Sixers. So incredibly defensive, because I think at some point they had to buy in. If you're a Philly fan and you really want to be interested in this team, you almost had to just be like, yep, I'm buying in. Because if not, it was just going
to
be misery.
I mean, it makes sense to buy in if you're a fan. I mean, that's your team.
Sure.
You're expecting, we're going to be successful. No one's going to be someone that expects to contend. You know, let's say, you know, Cavs fans. Cavs fans aren't going to be like, oh, this isn't our year. Screw it. Of course, they're going to be like, oh, this is our year. So, you know, Philly fans are sort of doing the same concept. You know, like, all right, this is our plan. I believe in it. Let's do it. So, I mean, if you say, no, your plan might be stupid, they're going to get defensive, just like most fans will in any other situation.
Sure. And it's kind of like they've been forced into that spot. You know, I mean, they had some pieces. They got rid of all of them. I love Thad Young. Drew Holiday's not bad. You know, they had some people. They could have worked it a different way. You know, we'll see.
I feel like they should have kept someone. That's the thing. I feel like they should have kept something. Like, I don't know, like just some sort of veteran presence.
But they couldn't, because that veteran presence would get so... I mean, you saw how mad Thad was.
Yeah, but I mean, let's just say, even keeping, maybe two, so they're not completely terrible.
Right.
But that's just it. This team's young, but, who's going to go to there? I mean, what player's going to go there and be like, oh, yeah, I believe I can help these young players?
Your veteran presence currently is the artist formerly known as Jason Richardson.
he ballooned up. Does he even play?
I honestly don't think so. I don't watch a lot of Sixers, but I don't think he does. I don't think he's played in 2 years, and he's just collecting $8 million.
Sounds like a job. He's
get that money. But, yeah, the Sixers perplex me. Anyway, let's move on to talk about the opposite of the Sixers, the Golden State Warriors, and more specifically, the god Steph Curry. He is on another level of fire right now. I've never seen a player that has the usage of that guy be as just unconscious for a long stretch.
Right. I mean, he's shooting 42% from three on 8 attempts a game, and 42% from three is below his career average. I don't even know how to comprehend that. It's just lights out, shooting. And then he's doing it in other aspects of the game, too. I mean, he's always had a decent dribble drive game. And this year, he's killing it right now.
He's hitting the dumbest pull-up, step-back threes I've ever seen. He's doing, tricky dribble moves. He's doing what Jamal Crawford does, but consistently. He's doing what Jamal Crawford does at, the end of quarters. But he does it, mid-third quarter on tight D, puts a cross on somebody, steps back. And his release is just so stupidly quick. The Warriors are so good. Steve Kerr, it really shows you how bad of an offensive coach Mark Jackson was.
I'm sorry, Mark Jackson.
No, I don't condone this.
That's unfortunate.
I just want the record to show I don't condone the singing of that. Steve Kerr has his team balling. He's got that offense flowing. It's just the fact that he's opened it up and he's got Bogut playing great ball. I saw an interview where Bogut completely, like, attributed his kind of bounce back this year to Kerr just because he believes in him. He's got them feeling better about everything. He's got that team together. There was a lot of, like, there were guys that were Mark Jackson guys and there are guys that weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a weird locker room dynamic. Steve Kerr's come in and just kind of taken that away a little bit. And they just play better. The bench unit plays better. That team...
Maurice Spates. Like, what the hell?
There's something about...
There is something about them. He's shooting...
Shout out to Noam Schiller for the worst Photoshop ever.
He's shooting 60% right now. And... Shouts
to Maurice.
Yeah. Ethan Sherwood's the Ralph Smith. He's probably going to regress. He's probably going to regress heavily. But he's done this for so long, it makes you pretty much believe that he could definitely swing a playoff series with bench play like this.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy what the Warriors are doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've got quite the start to the season.
For those not in the know, Maurice Spates is averaging 13 points per game in 15 minutes.
What?
Yeah.
I honestly didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's just dumb. That's crazy.
Yeah, it is.
There's no way that...
I mean, he's a little aggressive heavily, but still, I mean, he's done it for long enough now. It's like you could definitely... He's definitely could be a guy that could come in off the bench during a 7-game series and hopefully swing it if he is hitting like this.
That'd be crazy. If Maurice Spates is like...
Maurice Spates changes an NBA Finals with critical play off the bench.
Hey, Oregon Trail predicted it. Look back on that. That was Maurice Spates, the difference maker. I guess now we got Russ and KD on the way back. Russ is back. He jammed.
Yep.
He's back. KD's taken... He's close, I think. I can't remember if there's a date on when he comes back or if he's just... I know he's going through, like, closer to full practices and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exciting, but yeesh, they are...
They needed Russ back so much. I mean, of course they need KD back, but just getting one of them back was kind of huge.
Yeah, I mean, they had
nothing before that on offense.
Nothing. They got Reggie Jackson chucking.
Poor Serge. That's just not... he couldn't carry that team, and he's a really good player, but that was just not something he could do.
I mean, he's not a number one guy.
Yeah.
It's just, that's not him, and it's not a knock on him. It's just that's not who he is.
OKC is 29th in offensive rating. I don't think anybody would have expected that if you told them, like, 15 games in, they're going to be almost last in offense.
Oh, my goodness.
They're fifth in defense, though. That's a good sign.
Oh, boy. Nah, Joey Crawford's dancing again.
Is this televised?
That's televised dancing, poetry in motion.
See, we always talk about Memphis.
Memphis? I'm down.
Yeah. Grizzlies are 14-2, best record in the league.
Yeah.
What's your take on Robbie?
My take?
Yeah.
Thanks for that. Was a killer setup, by the way. They're good. That's my hot take on the Grizzlies. It's incredible how they win these games because they seem to find themselves in a fair amount of close games,
mm-hmm.
and they win them. So, I mean, the Grizzlies are just... Marc Gasol is just so good. He anchors that defense. Zebo is playing so well this year.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think we all keep waiting for the regression for Zebo.
He's averaging, like, 16 points and 12 boards a game, I think.
And it doesn't happen. Like, he's got such a phenomenal kind of old man game.
How old is he? Like, 34?
He's mid-30s.
Yeah.
I mean, and he's one of those guys that came in the league real young, so, like, he's got miles on the tires.
Gasol's killing it with the offense, too. That's been a pretty big shocker, almost. I mean,
what's he shooting? What's he shooting from the field?
He's averaging 20 points on 507 field goal percentage. 14 shots a game. So he's getting to the line 7 times a game.
Yeah, I mean, he's been a monster down there, and he's one of those guys that just is so skilled in both the low post and the high post that he's just a problem. Like, it's really tough to guard him. He's developed that mid-range jumper over the last few years to be really solid. And he's, you know, kind of speaking to the way he gets to the line, and this is something that Al Horford's talked about him trying to develop, is he's really good at the pump from the high post and driving, and he gets a lot of contact there.
Well, that's a thing, too, because, I mean, the way he passes the ball, too, from the high post, obviously, he just holds the ball up. I mean, like, you know, and just dishes from, you know, all the way up here, like, you know, 9 feet in the air where he's holding the ball. And yeah, then, I mean, that just also, he kind of shoots like that, too. And just, like, puts the ball up really high and shoots it.
He's got a pretty quick trigger because of the way he holds the ball up there. And he can give you that pump and go, and guys have just kind of left you so strong at the rim that you really have to get some good contact on to keep him from finishing. So, I mean, he's playing really well. You still have Courtney Lee shooting the ball well. He's kind of come back to earth a little bit, but he's still shooting it at a good clip. And they're just – Dave Yeager's done a killer job with that team. Like, he's got them – they still play tough defense. Like, they still play that – they still have Tony Allen playing, you know, killer defense on the perimeter. And they just do a really good job. And it's funny how they do it, because you think on their drafts and you're like, who have they gotten in the last couple of years that's made an impact?
Oh, that's...
Jordan Adams doesn't play.
Last
year they got...
they traded for Lawyer, right? And he still doesn't really even play that
long. Lawyer plays. Lawyer's not bad, but he wasn't somebody that they drafted.
Yeah, they traded for him.
They drafted... Who is that? I really wanted him for the Hawks. I can't remember. They got him like... Yeah, they got Jamal Franklin.
Is he not even on the team at this point? I feel like they cut him.
Damn. I remember they were excited about getting him in the second round.
Yeah, I was surprised he dropped all the way that far.
Because he got to the mid-40s, and they scooped him up in the 40s. And I remember they were talking to folks at Summer League for them, and they were excited about getting him. But Vince Carter's been terrific for them. You know, they do a really good job. Their drafting isn't great, but they do such a good job of finding veterans that fit what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And fill holes and fill needs, and they play a veteran friendly system. You know, it's pretty slow paced. They break it down in the half court. You know, they have, you know, Mike Conley can get out and run in transition, but Mark moves really well in transition.
Everybody on their team's pretty good defensive players. That always helps if you're like come in and you're not a great defensive player, just come in and be surrounded by other.
It's a system thing. You fit, like, Vince Carter's not a great defensive player at this point. I don't think he ever really was a great defensive player.
He was decent in Dallas, but that was also Carlisle, too.
Right, and so, like, I think that also helps. You see how Vince can work in the defense, and they've done a good job of making him comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so you look at it, and it's like, okay, this is an effective system. We know what players work, and they do a good job finding those guys, giving them on pretty good contracts. I mean, Vince is on a good deal, and they make it work. And so, you know, you got to give a lot of credit to the front office. You got to give a lot of credit to Yeager. And they just keep plodding along, and they've got that core. And, you know, it's funny, Marc Gasol is going to be a free agent next year. You have to figure they match anything, and they just throw money at him.
Yeah.
Like, you have to. He's the guy on that team that keeps everything together. Like, when he went down last year,
they were pretty bad.
For that stretch, like, they couldn't do anything. Like, they just were a shell of what they are with him, because he anchors that defense. He's one of the best defensive players in the league. There's a reason he's up there for Defensive Player of the Year every year. And offensively, he's become dynamic in the way that the offense kind of moves through him at that high post. If he gets a mismatch, he'll take somebody in the low post. And an underrated thing Mike Conley does, and this is something that frustrates me to no end about point guards nowadays, is Mike Conley's terrific at throwing into the post.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it goes back, I mean, he played with Greg Oden, right, at Ohio State.
Yes.
So, like, he's had a post presence throughout his kind of career. Like, he's always had guys. And so he knows how to throw post-entry passes. He doesn't throw guys off their spots. Nothing pisses me off more than watching a guard pick his dribble up at the wing and throw a guy who's on the block and walk him 5 to 10 feet out away from the basket because he throws it towards the corner.
A lot of point guards try to lob it in the entry pass when they don't need to. That's the thing. Like,
I saw Jeff do this last night trying to throw it into Al and it got deflected and tipped away. It's like they pick up the dribble and they kind of pump the pass. And when you do that, the defender kind of gets on the side and gets a hand up and makes it really difficult, so you have to throw him out. Conley does a really good job of keeping the dribble and making a quick pass in, usually low, sometimes high, but before the defender can get there. And when you do that, and all their guards are really good at that. And that's a really underrated thing. And if you have players in the post like Zebo and like Mark Gasol, if you keep them on their spots, I mean, every time you talk to a coach about what are you going to do against this dominant post player, whether it's Al Jefferson, Mark Gasol, any of them, they'll tell you we want to get them off their spot. As a guard, you can't be the one doing that.
Right.
You can't help the defense that way, because if Gasol is on the block 6 feet from the hoop, he's scoring or getting fouled 80% of the time. Like, he's just going to go look. If he's on the baseline 12 feet away, that percentage goes down a lot. You know, because you're going to be able to force him into that mid-range jumper that's not an efficient shot. It's harder for him to get to the free throw line from there. It's hard for him to drive off the baseline. So it's one of those things where guards need to know how to do that, and they have guards that can, led by Mike Conley. And it's a really underrated thing that every time I watch basketball, it angers me when guys can't do that. Like, I hate it.
I remember watching, this goes back to college a little bit, when Georgia Tech had Derek Favors and Ghani Lawal, who never really played much in the NBA, but he was really good.
He was a really good post guy in college. Right.
And Tech didn't have a guard that could get him to him. They were playing Amon Shumpert at point guard because they had to.
He's the only one that could dribble.
It was essentially almost like high school where you just have to have, like, your best, like, athlete almost that – at a position like that. Exactly. So they had to put him there, and he couldn't pass.
Right.
And so Tech has, you know, a bunch of great talent on that team, and then they get knocked out in, like, the second round and have a mediocre season in terms of expectations, because you have all these great players, but no, you can't get the ball to them.
Yeah, and it's an underrated thing, and you see a lot, and there's a lot of guys in the NBA that can't do it. I mean, it's one of the things that bugs me about Jeff Teague. He doesn't throw good entry passes. You see him get Al off the block a lot, Millsap off the block, just because a pass isn't that good.
And then, of course, Millsap and Horford are able to cover up that a lot just because how good they are from mid-range, and Millsap's off the dribble in terms of...
Right, but think about how much better they are on that low block. I mean, Paul's got a killer spin move. Al's got that little jump hook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally get what you're saying, but I'm saying, like,
Teague's
bad at it, but then Horford and Millsap are able to cover up just because they're good.
Right. So, I mean, I think it's a small thing, but that definitely helps Memphis's offense because it just makes them more efficient. Because you get them the ball in the right spots. It's not just positioning; it's making sure you execute. Memphis is really good, and they're going to be a problem for some of these teams, because when they're able to dictate the pace, it's hard for a lot of these teams to get going. And, you know, you always say playoff basketball slows down, and it doesn't have to if you're able to execute, but on defense they make it so hard for you to execute that they're able to dictate that.
Mm-hmm.
The same way the Spurs do. You know, the Spurs are really good at all that kind of stuff too, especially defensively. Your first option's rarely there. You know, and you have to go to 2, 3, 4, and by the time you do that, the game's slowed down. And that's why playoff basketball is slower. It's not because the offenses that are in there aren't quick, it's because you probably have more of the top half of the league in defense playing against you.
And the thing with the Spurs that make them so successful with their offense is when they have to slow down, they by, you know, time they slow down, but in terms of the ball movement, they don't slow down. And you see that with the Hawks too, under Budenholzer.
They move it so well in the half court.
Even if they take a long time to actually score, the ball's still moving. They still have a bunch of pace in terms of what's actually happening on the floor.
Pace and space.
Right. You know it.
Gonna get that tattooed on my forehead. So Bud can just read it off during his pressers.
So Bud, what is it you're looking for? This right here. Pace and space. All right. Thank you.
Pace and space. Cool. That's it. Yeah, so that's kind of my assessment of Memphis. I'm just excited for this season to kind of continue along, so we get to see, like, here's the question I'll ask for you. Is Toronto the best team in the East?
It's hard for me to say no at this point. They're playing
right. DeRozan's out, so that hurts.
That hurts. But with DeRozan, and possibly even with Lou. I mean, Lou's played well, and he'll be able to fill in some to where they won't fall too far without DeRozan. I mean, DeRozan's obviously a very good player.
Let's talk about the Louisville Renaissance, if you will. It's back open for business,
mm-hmm.
and he looks so much better than he did in Atlanta, and people ask a lot. They're like, "Oh, do you kind of kick yourself if you're the Hawks for letting him go for essentially nothing?" Which is wrong. The cap space they got, they were able to get Sabo with by cutting Salmons,
mm-hmm.
And also by cutting Salmons, they put him on the Pelicans, and that got them a game the other night. Salmons was terrible. So
I still think they could have gotten maybe a little more for Lou and Lucas.
Lou
wouldn't fit here. You had to get rid of him.
No. And you had to send an asset because nobody knew what Lou was. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Was he going to be the guy that was in Philly? And actually, I think being in Atlanta helped Lou some. Like, he learned to play off the ball some.
Lou's first year in Atlanta was great until he tore ACL.
Yeah, he was very good until the ACL. But he never fit with Bud. Like, that's what I tell people. He needs the ball in his hand. Like, he just does, and Toronto lets him do that. You see him with that second unit. He's got the ball a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But he's learned to play off the ball better because he played an offense that didn't demand him to be on the ball all the time. But he does need those ISO sets, and the Hawks literally don't run an ISO set. They'll run they'd run a pick and roll for him, mm-hmm. but they don't let him just break somebody down, which he likes to do. That gets him in rhythm. Like, that's the thing is, he used to try to do that, but he always had to do it at the end of a shot clock.
Right.
And so he'd hoist up a bad shot. If you can legitimately give Lou like 7 seconds to dribble, you don't really want the ball to stick all that much, but sometimes it's good for players. You know, some players are better when the ball sticks a little bit. You know, I think that's the thing with, you see it with Lance in New Orleans, or in, not New Orleans, he's in Charlotte. You see it with Lance, I keep thinking Hornets, but you see Lance and like, that's the reason he got benched is because the ball sticks. That's what Lance does. That's what they let him do in Indiana. They let him.
I mean, they didn't have anybody else that could score. Right? I mean, you had Paul George, but I mean, beyond
Paul
that,
George.
Paul George.
As Johan would say, Paul George.
I mean, that offense had no spacing. Like, I mean, at some point, you're just going to tell, all right, go create a shot. I mean, we don't have any spacing. You're not going to have space. You have to go make space.
Right. And the Hawks' problem with Lou was, the Hawks create space by ball movement. They don't kind of, I guess, naturally have it. They don't have guys that will just stand in a good spot on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they used to just kind of, like, Jeff would just stand way too close to Lou. Like, I always remember, like, Jeff would stand at the top of the key while Lou was on the wing. And it's like, Jeff, you got to move out.
And, of course, I mean, Korver creates space, obviously. But, I mean, you don't want him just standing there. That's not what you really want him to do. That's not what he wants to do.
And a lot of times Lou was the sub for Kyle.
Right.
And that's the exact opposite player. So that was the issue there. I also think, to be honest, there were some distractions in Atlanta for Lou. You know, he loved being in the community. He knows so many people here. You know, he's from South Gwinnett. He was out in South Gwinnett a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's not really a bad thing, but I do think, to an extent, there's a little extra pressure on him. He had, and especially when he came back, I think he felt a lot of pressure to be better than he could be. And it just didn't work. And so I think a change of scenery was good for him. I think a city like Toronto is good for him. And he seems happy there. He seems to be happy on the court. And that's good. And it's made that bench unit terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Toronto's bench, they whip the Hawks. Like, that's how they've won both of their games.
Yeah,
the Hawks.
Grievous Vasquez could probably start on several teams.
He could, but he wouldn't be good as a starter.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
He's such a good shooter.
That's what I'm saying. Like, that would get him in a starting rotation on some teams.
And the other thing is, Toronto has two of the all-time aggravators in the NBA right now.
Oh, good God, that's true.
They have Grievous Vasquez, who is an asshole. On the court, he's just a dick. Like, he's always kind of pressing up on guys, bumping into them. On offense, he likes to create that stupid little contact and try to get a foul. He gets a lot of those little, like, fouls on three-pointers because he drags the leg. And so he's a guy that pisses you off. So he's pissing guards off. And then you got Hansbro down there throwing elbows and knees and shoulders and headbutts. He's my least favorite player. Least favorite player in the league, Tyler Hansbro, but damn it if it's not effective because it pisses guys off and gets them out of the game.
And another thing, and I was talking to Kevin Arnovitz about this, Dwayne Casey's really good at hiding the deficiencies on that team. He knows his players' strengths, and he doesn't try to put them in situations where they're not going to succeed.
Right. Dwayne Casey's excellent.
Right.
And that's the thing with Lou is, like,
just letting them thrive in situations where he knows they can thrive and not trying to put them in spots where they're things they can't do. I mean, simply that.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is, like, there are coaches, like I think Coach Bud he's phenomenal, and he puts guys in position to thrive if they fit in his system. And his system isn't changing. They will change personnel before they change the system. And that's the thing with Lou is, like, Dwayne Casey will alter the game plan to let Lou do his thing. And it's not a knock on Bud, because Bud knows what works for him. And so if you put somebody like a Kyle Korver in his system, he's going to make Kyle Korver a phenomenal player.
Mm-hmm.
That is not going to happen for Lou Williams within Coach Bud's offense.
Right.
And also, Lou just couldn't play defense in the way Bud wanted to play defense. Like, Bud kept trying to play him at the three because he was trying to find a spot for him.
Well,
but
there were some injuries, too, so that didn't really help.
Well, that didn't help, but, you know, he would try to put Kyle and Lou on the floor together, and you'd get a switch, and you get a weird... And, like, you kept seeing poor Lou in the getting posted up by a 6'8", dude. Lou's 6'1". 180 pounds dripping wet. Like, just... But Kyle's big.
Yeah.
And, like, people talked about Lou could be Manu. It's like, Manu's 6'6", 220. Manu's big.
Yeah.
Like, you don't think he is, but he's a lot bigger than Lou Williams. So,
what are you talking about, Robbie? Six-man guard that can score. That's Manu Ginobili.
It's like, come on. Like, so that's my thing. And you know, Lou's got, you know, he helps Toronto a lot. I think he'll be really good to step in for DeRozan, but I do think it'll hurt that bench unit, you know?
Because
mm-hmm. Now you have, I guess, Grievous. It's your top option on that bench unit.
Yeah. I mean, have they played yet since DeRozan got injured?
I couldn't tell you.
But they might have, like, some data on who they tried to put in that foot.
This weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you boys locked in on football.
Been locked in on Hawks since they played both last
days. Right.
And, of course, that Georgia Tech football game.
Hey, how about them Jackets? So, yeah, I could not tell you what's going on with the Raptors' last game, if they've played since the DeRozan thing. But I think, you know, I think the best bet for them is to kind of stagger some of their rotations and maybe keep Terrence Ross out there more with the bench to give them their – Terrence Ross has been really good.
Mm-hmm.
They've just got a lot of guys that are playing. Jonas is finally doing what we knew he could.
He's killing it.
We knew he could. He was like – he destroyed Summer League 2 years ago, and we were all like, this is going to be your most improved player, and then he couldn't play defense.
He couldn't now, stay on the floor, and he was frustrating him.
He's in better shape now, it looks like. He's moving better. Like, I remember when the Hawks played them, the first game they played the Raptors last year, Jonas played 17 minutes because he was just getting run by Millsap and Horford, and Dwayne Casey benched him. And Dwayne Casey said after the game, he's like, he couldn't stay on the floor. He could not keep up. Mm-hmm. And when you take him out, all of a sudden they don't really have that, but anybody down low to defend. But this year they've remedied that with some guys. They got the Steamer now, who's another aggravator. They've got so many little aggravating guys. Kyle Lowry. Oh, my God. Kyle Lowry, top tier. I even forgot about him.
Yeah.
I hate so many people in Toronto. But
a lot of them, you know, they're good except for him.
They're good because if they're not on your team, you hate them. They have, like, the all-star lineup of guys where you're just like, I hate them, but if they were on my team, I'd love them.
Mm-hmm.
Except for Kyle Lowry. I don't want to see that guy.
Amir Johnson's been really good, too.
Who?
Amir Johnson.
James Johnson. Johnson and Johnson. Amir's really good in the post. And he can shoot that mid-range.
James Johnson's terrifying on defense.
Oh, my God. He's so big and fast. And it's one of those things where he was in Hawks camp that one year and got cut.
Mm-hmm.
He was with the Grizz, and he seemed like a perfect Grizz player. Like, they even did the little neck tattoo thing. By the way, the Grizz marketing department is the best in the league at promotions. They did the James Johnson neck tattoo. They've got the Zeebo bow tie, which I actually just got a text from a friend saying we're driving to Memphis for that night. I'm sure. Memphis's promotion department should. I don't know if there's an award for that, but they should win it if there is.
I just want to show the turnaround here for James Johnson.
Please.
In Sacramento, the year before he was on Memphis, he was a minus, like, 13 efficiency differential.
Yep.
And then with Memphis, he was plus 6.5.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Toronto, he's been plus 4. So, I mean, he's essentially completely...
And he's playing more in Toronto.
Yeah, he's completely flipped the script on what he was doing in terms of impact.
And it's... Well, it's another thing. I mean, the Kings were a team that didn't know how to win either. That's another one where it's like they played such weird basketball back then. And they looked so much better. Boogie dominated Anthony Davis the other night.
Mm-hmm.
Just put him to work, which... Davis shouldn't be on Boogie all that much because Boogie's so big. But, yeah, I mean, James Johnson, you sit there and you're like, man, the Hawks could use that wing defense. But he wasn't the off. But, again, he didn't fit the scheme. And he just didn't – like, he's one of those guys that's just tenacious on the ball, and the Hawks don't do that. Like, we don't pressure that much. Like, Bud's toned down Damari's pressure. And James just wanted to get after it. Like, you can see kind of a lineage, the Tony Allen wing defender lineage of guys that kind of, like, if you ask Damari how he became the defender, he'll tell you it's because of his first 3 years in Memphis under Tony Allen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's told me that, and I think James Johnson learned a lot from Tony Allen. The Tony Allen school of defense, I think any wing defender that is a fringe player that can't shoot, they should go to Memphis for an offseason and work with Tony Allen, because he teaches those guys how to be an effective player without having any shooting ability. Like, Tony Allen can't shoot.
No. Nope.
Like, you leave him wide
open. Tony Allen can't score.
No, he can't finish.
He can't shoot layups, really.
No, it's... But he's a plus player. So... Any NBA wing players that are fringe that listen to this podcast? All none of you?
Anybody that might hear this in passing? Because all none of you?
And pass that word along? Tell them to go see Tony.
I just noticed this Tony Allen's basketball reference page has his nickname listed as the Grindfather, and that's awesome to see that it's actually recognized somewhere.
That is official. Yeah. No, it's so good. So, I mean, you look at... You know, I think they won't be for a while just because being without DeRozan is going to hurt that rotation and the depth. But
oh, yeah, we were talking about the Raptors.
We were talking about that, like, 10 minutes ago. We're, you know, it's time's a flat circle. And I think they could be the best team in the East when he comes back. It's hard to deny what they're doing. As much as I dislike a lot of those guys.
I mean, I expect Chicago to be good. I expect Cleveland to be good. But until they actually show me they can be better than Toronto, I've got to pick Toronto.
Yeah.
I mean,
Cleveland's super weird.
Yeah.
They beat the hell out of the Hawks, and then they lose to the Nuggets, and then they beat the hell out of somebody, and then they lose. And LeBron looks miserable half the time. And then he does something like last night and throws that little no-look pass, and you're like, hey, this is what they could do. But, I mean, we're gonna go long on this. I don't care.
Yeah. Go for it.
What's Cleveland need to do? You hate to say 17, 15 games in the season they need to make a move, but at this point we're nearing the quarter pole of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a pretty good idea of what you are and what you aren't. What are the changes in Cleveland that have to happen? Because they have to change. It's not going to just click. Like, people, like, Miami changed. When they were 9-8, Miami changed. Spo made some changes. They tweaked what they were doing and how they were doing it. Cleveland's got to do that. Do they need to deal somebody? Blatt needs to change what he's doing. For sure.
I think
offensively. Offensively and defensively, Blatt's got to – he's got to let go of some of his
Euro. Offensively, they're fine. They need something.
But here's the thing is I don't think offensively they are. Like,
I think they're
fine. They're good,
yeah.
But I think they're not consistent. They're just not. And it's – Kevin Love's not making shots. Kevin Love looks uncomfortable in offense. Like, you've got to get them in position – you've got to – this goes back to tailoring – your system for players. Blatt's not in a situation where he can go get players to fit his system. Those are the players you have. You don't go out and get Kevin Love and LeBron James and put them with Kyrie and then all of a sudden go, well, I guess we should change personnel a lot. Like, that's your personnel. You better change what you're doing. Put some pick and rolls in. Like, get rid of some of this Euro shit that you're doing and just accept that what you have is what you have. You're not coming to a fresh slate where you get to blow everything up. That's who you are. Those are your players, and they need to. They've got to fix some things, and I think Kevin Love and LeBron should just be running pick and rolls. Kyrie and Love should be running pick and rolls. They don't. It's frustrating as hell.
I remember when the Hawks were about to go play them. I think it was the night before. They're on the back-to-back, I think, in Cleveland.
Yeah.
Korver just remarked it. It's like, whoever they played on before had, like, a really small backcourt. And someone asked him about that. And he's just like, they've got a big one tomorrow. They're playing Sean Marion at the two. It's just like, what are you doing playing Sean Marion at the two? Like, you can't... It's not going to work.
It's wild. It's wild. Yeah. It's wild what they're doing.
I mean, I get you want some sort of defensive presence in there because they're pretty... not good on defense. I mean, they're not terrible, but they're not good.
But that happens when you have. I mean,
that happens when you have Kyrie.
Kevin Love's your rim protector. Yeah. Kevin Love allows like I saw. I think it was a Goldsberry shot chart where Kevin Love's allowing like 60% at the rim when he's on the floor. Opponents are shooting like 60% at the rim.
Mm-hmm.
That is staggering. Like they're giving up way above league average at the rim when Kevin Love's on the floor, and like. You know, you ask anybody, you ask Harper or anybody, they'll be like, yeah, that's Kevin Love. Like, a lot of people, you know, rebounding's part of defense, but when people aren't missing shots, it's not.
That was the thing that he kind of was able to get by with Pekovic and Minnesota.
Well, Pekovic's not a defensive guy, but...
Yeah, I mean, in terms of defense.
He's just large.
I mean, in terms of defense, it's like, all right, we can just grab all of the rebounds, don't foul.
Yeah,
and let them shoot
like
50-something
percent.
I think as a team they gave up like 56% at the rim, but they were like the ninth best defense.
Yeah, because
they could just grab all the rebounds and they didn't foul, so that was just. I mean,
well, that's the other thing is, outside of I mean, none of the guards for Cleveland can rebound.
I know.
None of them. Like Kyrie is not getting. Kyrie's like Jeff Teague. He's not putting his nose in there.
He's gonna have a career high 4 rebounds. What you're saying?
Like 6 years into his career, Jeff Teague got here putting up career highs with 4 boards. He's just not gonna do it. Like he's not. And Deion Waiters is somewhat not all there on defense. Like, he just mentally just, he's not going after things.
Mm-hmm.
He's a big body. He should be able to rebound, but he just kind of checks out sometimes.
Deion Waiters is pretty enormous. I noticed that when he was in Atlanta, like, I think it might have been his rookie year or second. I just noticed him. I was like, is that Deion Waiters? Because he was jacked. I didn't know he was that big. Like, Jesus.
He's huge. Yeah, no, I remember watching him warm up, and I was like, who's the guy, who's the short power forward? Like, who is that guy? Oh, no, that's Deion. Because I saw him from the back, and I'm like, his shoulders are so big.
Yeah, I think I was telling you that. I think that's Deion. It's like, no, that can't be Deion. He looks too big.
They've got some guy on the end of the bench that's out here. He's small. He's like, just short. Yeah, he's just short. He can't play. Yeah, and then you got Deion just hucking up shots. I think they moved Deion.
I mean, they kind of have to. He really doesn't fit.
No, he doesn't.
I mean, he's sort of a guy that wants to have the ball. He's not. I mean, he's been a decent. He was a decent 3-point shooter last year, but he's not going to be a guy that's going to sit there and spot up from three.
He won't. He won't. Well, he will if you pass him the ball. I think one of my favorite vines is him at the end of the clock just, like, clapping for the ball. Like, demanding it from LeBron, who's just like, no.
No.
The struggle's so real for Deion. And he's a – like, I think Deion Waiters is truly a player that can succeed in the league, but not with the Cavs. And Conrad or whoever might get upset. Like, oh, no, Deion's good. I'm not saying Deion's not good. He's just not good for the Cavs.
Hey, he was good last year.
He's good
last year, but now with that with personnel not, on not that with, team, he can't succeed. It's not an environment for him to succeed with the personnel that's on that team.
I mean, it's what we talked about with Lou. Like, some guys just don't fit with a certain scheme. Some guys don't fit with a certain group of personnel. Deion doesn't fit because the thing about Deion is when you especially on defense, like, you can't have him and Kyrie defending on the perimeter together. They're a sieve. Like, it's not going to work.
It doesn't help that, I mean, LeBron's 30 and isn't the defensive player he used to be either. That can just cover that up.
That LeBron sometimes looks like he could care less about playing defense. And, okay, so I'm going to say this and probably regret it if anybody pulls it. LeBron's entering the Kobe stage of defensive apathy at times.
He was pretty bad last year, too.
He's one of those guys that there are times where you look at him and he'll get mad because he reads the things that are, you know, he'll read something and he'll be like, oh, I'll show you. You know, like the shit Kobe does when he decides, oh, I'm going to pass tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Or, oh, like against the Hawks, Kobe showed up and played defense. Like that night he was hounding Thabo. LeBron will do that. But he can't do that every night, and it's one of those things where he's such a good effort player, you know, like, but when he's not putting in the effort, like, he's pretty freaking average at best. Like, if he's out there just going through the motions, like, he's super average on defense, and he just can't get up every night. I mean, he's played more minutes.
He's played a stupid amount of minutes in his career.
He's played, like, he's in the top 15 now of, like, minutes or something stupid like that. Because of playoffs and all that. Like, he's gone deep in the playoffs so many times. Like, his minutes are crazy. The Cavs have some issues. I'm not here saying that they don't have a title shot. They certainly do. They're way too talented not to. You put them in a 7-game series, they could get it. But there's definitely changes that need to be made. I think Blatt needs to tweak what he's doing on both sides of the ball.
Let's go back for a second. I think part of that is LeBron has to sort of relearn how to play the three.
Yeah, that's true.
He played the four essentially his last 3 years in Miami so much. Like, he just has to literally relearn that he's not playing against those kind of guys anymore.
And I think that's also hurting their spacing a little bit on offense. You know, he became a really good shooter, but he was also getting different looks because he was at the four, so he was getting different guys on him.
And it hurts not having – I mean, you have Kevin Love playing the four, obviously, but then you have Varejao playing the five. Kind of
right.
He's played well this year. Varejao's played very well. He's a good player, but I mean, he does kind of put a bit of a damper on the spacing that LeBron was used to in Miami.
For sure. So, I think there's and so you know, I think they'll be fine. I keep saying they'll be fine, and then they're not every week, but it's early. But like they're going to be okay, but they're not going to be okay if they don't really actually try to make some changes.
Mm-hmm.
I think the too long didn't read of that entire conversation is the Cavs need to kind of set an ego aside a little bit and be like, we need to work on some things. You know, like some things have to change. Because they just don't, especially defensively, they don't have it. Like, they just don't have the pieces to be the defensive team that the Heat were.
They don't have Bosh. I mean, that's... And then to an extent, Wade. I think Wade does get short credit on what he did on defense his first couple of years with that team.
Especially, yeah, when he was still healthy, like, he was really good. So, yeah, and the other thing is, like, as much as we can shit on Mario Chalmers and Norris Cole, they're pests on the ball.
Mm-hmm.
They're super annoying defenders. Like, they're not great, but they pressure the ball the way Kyrie can. Or doesn't try to. One of the two.
Yeah, Kyrie's dreadful on defense. That's about the only way to put it.
It's tough. So, yeah, for now, I'm going to proclaim Toronto the best team in the East. Somebody say that and make it sound stupid a little bit.
I agree so far. They've been the best team.
I
don't see any reason to say that anyone else is the best team in the East.
I'm talking a little Hawks. You were there. You've been there for, what, three games this week?
Yeah.
A lot of action.
Yeah, they were.
Thanksgiving week.
Three games in 4 days all at home. That was weird. I don't know if I ever
Feast week at Phillips Arena. What you been seeing?
There's been some much better defensive play. I mean, up to, like, obviously that Cleveland game was kind of everything came to a head with bad defense combined with the team really hot shooting.
Right.
But they're definitely playing better on defense. They limited both the Pelicans and the Hornets to 28 points in their first half.
Yeah, I mean...
Part of that's bad shooting, obviously. But, I mean, that's the point. I mean
the Hornets are atrocious.
You're forcing bad shots from... Well, New Orleans is pretty good on offense. But that was the thing. You were forcing bad looks.
I said the Hornets.
Yeah, but I was about to say two bad offensive teams, but New Orleans is actually really good on offense. They were forcing, you know, teams to take, you know, hard shots, and they missed them. So, I mean, that was, you know, they were forcing...
That's all you do in NBA defense. Yeah. Like, teams are going to get shots. Your job is to make them take tough ones.
Yeah, they're taking tough shots, and Hawks are making them work the clock. I mean, that's about all you can expect out of a defense, and it worked. And they're moving up in the defensive ratings. I think they're 20th now instead of 26th, which is where they were the other day.
I think a lot of that is you're seeing... Al Horford's, one, he's able to play a few more minutes, and two, you see he's moving better. He wasn't in shape at the beginning of the season, you could tell. Just game shape.
Also, missing Damari Carroll for a couple of games kind of hurt.
That will hurt.
Yeah.
Mainly because you don't have anybody on the bench. Like, he's so much better than Thabo. Like,
he can play offense, too. But, I mean, that's not translating to defense, but...
No, but, well, it kind of does.
Yeah, it can.
When you miss less shots, you don't have to play defense on the run.
Mm-hmm.
You set up. So there's certainly something to that. Dennis Schroeder has been a marvel. He is playing so well and finally looking... I mean, I feel weird saying finally about a kid who just turned 21. But he's kind of showing what we thought, and I think a lot of it's the fact that he's just confident in himself.
Yeah, he's definitely, I mean, he's taken jumpers with impunity almost, and I think you mentioned this. On layups, he's not trying to do some stupid scoop shit and come up from, like, his waist to try for a layup where he's actually holding the ball up and going in.
Yeah. Yeah.
That game against Charlotte, I think this will be a good lead-in to what you want to talk about, where they were winning by 40, and we're saying the Hornets needed Anthony Tolliver back to cut it to 20 times two.
Tolly, that one year, I think there were, like, 8 different games. We were bad for a stretch.
Yeah.
And there were, like, at least 6 to 8 games where Tolliver would cut the lead to, like, 20 points for the other team. and that just kind of became his role.
come in and cut it to 20.
It was so good. Speaking of Tali, we'll get into a little story time. So, 2 years ago, I've got a story about last year's as well, but we'll save that for another time. 2 years ago, at Hawks Casino Night, which is their charity function that they do each year, it's at Opera Nightclub in Atlanta. They set up a bunch of casino games, and people buy tickets, and it all goes to the Hawks Foundation to do what they do. They build basketball courts, support all the NBA care stuff, all that good stuff. So, it's, you know, all the season ticket holders are there, a lot of people are there, and all the players have to be there. And it's a wonderful night to be one of the media folks there, because players normally don't want to talk to us. However, when the option... when the options are talk to a bunch of fans or talk to somebody they know in the media, they will always choose to talk to you. So it's a wonderful night for me to get background on stuff and just generally get to know some of the guys. And my first year, I was kind of nervous. I didn't know a lot of the guys that well. You know, I'd talk to them and I would say what's up. But me and Tali hung out for like an hour and a half at the roulette table, just spinning it. Like, we were hot. We were just hitting numbers. And so we were there for a while, and there are beverages available for free, and I enjoy those. it was my first year, so I didn't know how to pace it there. So I had a few extra... Gentleman Jacks, shout out to the sponsors, that's a classy sponsor.
Yeah. Like,
Gentleman Jack, top shelf. That's good stuff. So I'm knocking those back. There's a guy like in the corner hand rolling cigars, which was all me and Nick Van Exel were over there just like taking cigars. Like, at one point, he had, like, five in his front pocket. Shouts to Nick Van Exel. And so I'm at the roulette table, and at one point, I was like, I'm going to go get another drink. And Tyler was like, yeah, get me a water. And so I come back, and everybody's kind of erupting. I told him just bet what he's betting. And we all hit, like, 10 or something like that. And so we're all excited and kind of jumping around and high-fiving because we won fake money. And so, like, I set my drink on the table and kind of, like, turned. We were high-fiving. And the tables were kind of shoddy. Like, it was two tables put together. I don't know why I'm doing hand motions. Y'all can't see me. But it's, like, two tables put together. And so, like, people were kind of bumping it. And the table collapses in the middle. Drinks and chips, and this is in the middle. Like, this isn't in a back corner. This is in the middle of the main room. And it just collapses, and everything stops around us. And me and Tolliver are just standing there. Like, all right. And so that's how I broke a roulette table with Anthony Tolliver. And they put it back together, and we were back up and running in, like, 10 minutes. But, yeah, so if you ever go to, like, a casino night, make sure that they have real tables or you might break them. It's a problem. Later that evening, I was talking to somebody, like Jenkins or somebody, and at the end of the night, everybody puts their chips in and gets raffle tickets. And even the players enter the raffle, which seems really weird to me. But whatever. So, Johan Petro,
the legend,
Hawks legend Johan Petro, who is French, which made this all so perfect and almost seems staged, won the raffle for a wine and cheese basket. Sure.
And what so else Petro would French people win, by. Robbie?
What?
What else would French people win in a raffle, Robbie?
I don't know. Apparently, just cheese and wine. Like, and so he was coming back by, and I was joking with him that, you know, he should give me one of those bottles of wine. And he did. So, to this day, it's still in my room. I haven't figured out what the proper time to open it is. I think it'll be for birthday celebrations this year. I have a bottle of wine given to me by Johann Petro.
Classy.
It looks like it's pretty nice. Looks pretty nice. Because apparently Petro doesn't drink, so he was just like, yeah, take it. So that's casino night. If you ever get a chance to go, they're incredibly fun. Like, if any of the teams around you post something like that, like, they're really fun. You get to talk to players and fake gamble with them.
Win fake money.
Big money. Big time. Anyway, that's casino night. That's how you break a table with an NBA player.
Nice.
Excellent. What else are we going to talk about? The East is big, man. Shout out to Woody. Oh, my gosh. Then you got, yeah. Are the Clippers doing better? I don't watch much of them.
Yeah, they are.
Are they? That's good. They're a good team.
Mm-hmm.
That's not enough.
They're doing good. All right, yeah, that's good.
Pretty good buckle. And Woody got me thinking about the Clippers because he's on that bench now. By the way, the facial hair on that Clippers on the Clippers during November for this Movember, Doc Rivers. Woo! That mustache. I think one of my favorite little Doc Rivers quick story, and I guess we'll end it. One of my favorite Doc Rivers things was that last year when he was in town. The visitor's locker room in Phillips, outside of it, they have, down that hallway, they have a lot of, like, the
that was when Popovich was on down, I think, is that what you're thinking of?
No, okay. This one's Doc. No, Pop has a good one.
Go on.
Because they didn't find the same picture.
Yeah.
So, it was funny, they do the visitor's coach before the game outside the locker room, and across the hall are pictures of all the Hawks former greats, and Doc Rivers is one of them, and he's the one closest to the locker room. For whatever reason, they didn't do the normal spot. The Clippers didn't have a TV backdrop, so Doc just kind of moseyed over, and he didn't even notice. He just kind of stood in front of his picture, and somebody pointed it out to him, and he was like, man, that was skinny back then, and just kind of like looked and kind of like grabbed his stomach. He was like, what happened to that guy? And yeah, Pop
did the same thing, because we were talking to Pop, and he looked around, and he's like, wow, Doc's gained some weight since then.
He was like, Doc's gotten fat. I love Popovich. I don't care what anybody says. Pop's great. So, yeah, and the Spurs are starting to come on. Spurs are Spurs.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing their thing. Speaking of Pop.
They're 11-4 all of a sudden.
Yeah, I remember we were like, man.
They're like 2-3, and now they're like 11-4.
It's what the Spurs do. They're stupid. Aaron Baines hit like a shot clock beating three the other night. Like, I'm just like, how do they do this with guys? Like, also, I lost a prop bet with somebody. We bet on how much overweight Boris would come back after getting that contract. He came back in shape.
Killing it, too.
Good job, Boris. Former Hawks legend.
Boris playing 30 minutes a game.
Drafted as a point guard, Boris Diaw. He was Pop C before Pop C. The god. I need a Pop C jersey in the worst way.
No, you don't.
I do. It's the only jersey I want of the Hawks. Everybody else, I don't care. Pop C. I thought he was actually going to come over and play at one point.
Didn't he play? He did play, didn't he?
No, he came over for like an offseason. I think he was on the team 1 year. I think he has like 2 playoff minutes in his career.
Let's look at Popsy's basketball reference page. It's got to be one of the more depressing pages on that website.
Or, if you look at it right, one of the more impressive ones.
3 games, 21 minutes in his career.
Pop.
Scored 7 points.
Hey, you extrapolate that? Pop can score. Somebody needs to give Popsy a chance. He's like 30.
He's only 26.
What? What year was that?
2011.
God, that was the year before I started coming to the team. Damn, I miss Pop. by 1 year. Was that the year they had Ethan Thomas?
Ethan Thomas, I think, was maybe a year before. I don't know. Let's click on the 2010-2011 Hawks roster.
I want to... So,
Josh fucking Powell's probably on this team, right?
Oh, God. Former Laker legend. Yeah, that was the year after he was, like, decent for the Lakers, and people thought he was going to be good.
That was, I think, yeah, I think it was... Let me check. There's a Tom Thomas and Hilton Armstrong, Josh Powell.
That team went to the playoffs, by the way.
Damian Wilkins.
Oh, God. How did we get to the playoffs that year?
Steez was on this team before he was good.
Steez. Did you say before Steez was good?
I said he's never really good. You have old Mike Bibby on that team, too.
Fuck Mike Bibby.
That
team was a playoff
of course,
team.
I mean, you had Joe Johnson. And Josh.
Man, that was
bench.
God,
that good. Bench is miserable.
Foul. That is a foul bench. The East was bad. It's always been bad. Can somebody fix it? Can we seriously do what we said on the last podcast and seriously trade some teams out of the East? So bad every year. The media in Atlanta hates Ethan Thomas because of Thomas, and it still is in existence for some unknown reason, is on locker cleanout day and exit interviews, they no longer allow the media in the locker room. And this is why. Because Ethan's locker was, I believe, next to Joe's. And so he was trying to clean out his locker. And he was mad because the media was talking to Joe, and he didn't have enough room to clean his locker out. So now we do the interviews awkwardly waiting outside, and sometimes you don't get guys because they go out the back door. Blame Ethan. So that's why nobody likes Ethan Thomas.
I'm just looking at this. The Hawks have like eight guys with a sub 10 PER on that bench.
Kurt
Heinrich.
How far did that team didn't go to the second round, did they?
I think they did. I think so. Yeah, the year they finally beat Orlando.
Oh.
That was the Jason Collins year.
Oh, man. Jason Collins became a legend that year because he would foul Dwight six times a game.
But we wouldn't double him, so nobody else scored. But Dwight had like a 46 and 20 in like the first game of that series, I think.
That was so... I missed Twin for that reason. He was so good against Dwight, and as soon as Dwight left the East, we got rid of Twin. Jason Collins is one of the nicest human beings I've ever met. And I mean, anybody that's interacted with him, I know he's gotten a lot of press in the last year or two, but... I remember there was a game, it was a playoff game his last year, and the only two people, the Hawks had lost the game, and they did shoot around the next day. And the only two people that came to talk to us, it was Larry Drew, and then the only two players that didn't sneak out the back door and talk to the media were Marvin Williams and Jason Collins, who had not played in the night before. And Jason Collins gave us like an 8-minute long interview. Essentially talking about what he saw from the bench. It was hilarious. I wrote like two entire articles based off of Jason Collins quotes, a guy that hadn't played in the game. Because
brilliant.
Every single other person, Joe, Jeff, Josh, everybody slipped out the back. And the reason we couldn't use the practice court and avoid them going out the back was because Nickelback was in town, and Nickelback security was being a dick and gave us the runaround. So screw Nickelback too. And so we had to be in like the front hallway, and everybody went out the back. Nickelback, man. God, I hate Nickelback. So Nickelback and Ethan Thomas are like.
Interview blockers?
Yeah, media blockers. And Mike Bibby is the legend. All-timer. He'd tell you he's going to the trainer's room and then grab all this stuff and leave. He'd be like, yeah, I'll be right back. It's like, Mike, you got your coat on.
And then he waddled out of the...
He waddled out. And then he got ejected from his son's AAU game. I think we should end on that. Yeah. That's there we go.
Fuck Mike Bibby. So that was the ending.
Just fuck Mike Bibby. There you go. This has been fun, once again. If anyone has made it to the hour 20 mark of this podcast, God bless you. And
we appreciate it.
We do. We don't. Yeah, we just do this for fun. Hopefully you all enjoy it. Some stories. I guess analysis. I don't know. I just said the Clippers were good. That's the best analysis I can come up with.
That was like Budenholzer's, where we're talking about Anthony Davis. It's like, Anthony Davis is really good. That was a
shocker. Well, I mean, to be honest,
I tweeted about that too. I was like, Mike Budenholzer describes Anthony Davis as really good.
Breaking news. But, I mean, to be honest, somebody asked him the question, like, what do you think of Anthony Davis? Like, be a little more specific. So thanks for listening. It's been fun. We'll be back at some point again in the next week or so. Bo, thanks for coming on as always.
Always a pleasure.
It's good times.
Yeah, it is.
All right. So thanks, everybody. This has been ATL Charlie Hoops. We'll try to be better next time, as always. Enjoy your week.